I really need to organize things. Never mind the stuff in the background. I have like mom's stuff, you know, like scrapbooking kinds of things. Picture with me and Robert Englund at Horror Hound this year. My niece did this diamond painting of Alice from Alice in Wonderland and more baby scrapbooking things. Car driving by. Not the most ideal background if you're watching me on YouTube, but we are back with the Spooky Mom podcast episodes. This episode, we're going to Springfield, Oregon. Beautiful Oregon. Beautiful state, not a beautiful story. May 21st, 1998. This was a year before. Well, I don't think it was a full year, but a year-ish before Columbine. This is a school shooting story. I don't see a lot of the people that I watch who cover true crime talk about this one. I don't know if it's that people in general stay away from school shooter stories. I know a lot of people have issues with even putting their names and faces in articles because they feel like they're giving them the attention that they want or they're glorifying them. But if you think about it, no true crime story is nice. Like, I don't think anybody's trying to glorify any of these people, but they are at the very least interesting stories. And this story in particular, I guess at the time, made national headlines. I never heard of it. I did hear about Columbine the following year, but I first heard about this story when I was living in Seattle and I was obsessed with everything Pacific Northwest. Still am, but currently located in Nashville. I was listening to a specifically true crime podcast about crime in Pacific Northwest. So that is where I first heard about this story. And there's always certain stories that when you hear about them, they stick with you. There's some element about it that you can't forget and makes you want to learn more. So this is definitely one that when I heard about it, I was shocked. And then when I saw the person that did it, saw their mugshot and heard everything that they did, it's just something that's seared in my memory. And I knew that I wanted to do more research on it. And that when I had a true crime podcast of my own, I thought this would be an episode that I'd like to do. So, Thurston High School, Springfield, Oregon. The story centers around a boy named Kipling Kinkle, 15 years old, who was born in 1982, only 4 years older than me. I was 12 at the time. He had an older sister who was a gifted student, and he was not a gifted student. He had a lot of issues, as we will see, and was often compared to his sister, but his sister was quite a bit, well, a bit older than him. I think she was 4 or 5 when he was born. And she seemed to be really motherly towards him. And it seems that they had a good relationship. Both of his parents were Spanish students and, by all accounts, good parents. Although, I don't know. I was going to say that's up for debate, but I think in hindsight, and especially these days, knowing everything that we do now about mental health, I could say that the good parent part is up to debate, but I don't know. I guess as parents, I'm a parent. I'm not a very seasoned parent. My kid just turned 4, but I think we all do try our best. And sometimes, despite that, things are out of our control. Bad things can happen, even when we try our very best with our kids to keep them safe. So I think it's probably correct that they were good parents, but like all of us, they made mistakes. And one of those mistakes is when they started taking Kip to psychologists, psychiatrists with his issues. He had a lot of behavioral issues. He was very interested in destruction. And so his parents, when they felt like they could no longer handle him, started taking him to see professionals, but they concealed widespread mental health illnesses that were on both sides of the family. And obviously, if you're taking your kid in to see a psychiatrist, they need all the information that they can work with to give your kid the best care that they can. And if they're not aware of something that significant, your kid's not getting, you're not doing your kid any good. The teacher said that Kip was immature and lacking physical and emotional development. His parents held him back in the first grade. He had dyslexia and was in special education classes by the time he was in the second grade. Classmates said that he was morbid, strange, psychotic, and schizoid, which is weird because it contradicts other accounts where I saw videos of people saying, or read articles of people saying, that he was actually popular in the class clown. So which is it? Or could it be both? Or does it depend who you talk to? He was obsessed with the 1996 version of Romeo and Juliet, the one with Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes. I guess at the time he had a girlfriend and they broke up when they started covering Romeo and Juliet in school, and that only furthered his obsession. As a kid, he liked guns and explosives. His dad enrolled him in a gun safety course and then bought him guns. That might be shocking to you or me. I, for one, am not a fan of guns. I don't want guns anywhere near my kid. But apparently in this part of Oregon, it was somewhat rural, and in the mid 90s in a rural area in Oregon, I guess it was somewhat commonplace for kids this age to have guns, to know how to handle guns, to have access to guns. But that is not advised. It does not sound like a recipe for anything good to me. Later on, his parents had to enroll Kip in anger management, and they were scared that they didn't know how to help him anymore. It's like they wanted to help him, but they were embarrassed of his behavior. They were embarrassed of their family history. So it's like they wanted to help, but they also wanted to protect their family, their image maybe. And later on, after all the events that we're gonna get to happen, it will be discovered that Kip most likely had paranoid schizophrenia, but he had tried to hide all of his symptoms due to mental health stigma, and he had been hearing voices since he was 12. And having hallucinations and paranoid delusions. He thought that China was going to invade the West Coast and that the government put a computer chip in his brain, and the voices were telling him to kill his parents and commit the shooting at the school. Friends said that he'd always talked about violence and joining the army to kill someone. He was also treated with major depression, but his parents stopped taking him because he seemed to get better. He was on Prozac, and once his prescription ran out, his parents did not continue him on it. So obviously, if you're on any kind of medication, you need to be under the care of a doctor. If you decide to go off medication, you need to go by doctor's advice. going cold turkey, you know, and things like that, especially for something this serious, is not a good idea. And it just goes to show that people that don't have an understanding and are more concerned about appearances can sometimes not make the best choices when it comes to caring for somebody who is severely affected with mental health issues. So, the events preceding this main part of the story, that while we're all here, he got expelled for having a gun at school. He bought a gun. It was a stolen gun. I guess probably a kid stole it from their parents, and he paid, I think it was like something like $110 for this gun. Somehow school authorities were tipped off about this and found the gun in his locker. He got expelled. He gave a lot of excuses for what he later did. It's a little bit confusing just because, I don't know, his reasons kind of conflict to me. Maybe it was a combination of things. After he was expelled, he said that he just couldn't bear his parents to be embarrassed by him. And so after an argument with his dad was sitting at his kitchen table. Kid comes downstairs with a gun and shoots his dad in the back of the head while he's having his coffee, and then drags him off to the bathroom and puts a sheet over him. Then he realizes that his mom could never forgive him for what he did, and that he had to do the same to her, but he had to wait for her to get home. This reminds me a lot of a story that happened in Pensacola, Florida, where I used to live. It was over a decade ago, but there was this 14-year-old boy named Warren Williams. His family was pretty well off. They lived in this really beautiful part of town. I think the road is called Scenic Highway. It was like off of Scenic Highway in this really beautiful, heavily wooded neighborhood. And his dad worked for the airlines in some high up position. And one night while his mom was away from the house at a PTA meeting, his dad was downstairs watching like Survivor or something on TV. And he shoots and kills his dad. But his family had a messed up history. He had an older brother that had committed suicide years before. Supposedly there may have been abuse in the home. But the difference there is Warren calls 911. He gets arrested, but his mom lives. And I think his mom would visit him in jail, try to get his sentence lessened. His grandparents were supportive of him. And stuff like that, like you'll see here with Kiplin Kinkle. I almost said Kip Kinklin. Kiplin Kinkle. His sister was very supportive of him after all this, which is wild to me. How, I know that it can be hard when you love a family member and it's very hard for you to reconcile what they did with your love for them, but I would just be thinking, you know, if I was at home, would that have been me too? You know, like I couldn't have that level of support for somebody in my family that did something like that. I just could. But of course, you know, you never know until you're in that position, which I hope I never am. But it's hard for me to see being that supportive and not fearing for my own safety. Because I'm sure your other family members that wound up dead never thought that their own son or whatever would do that to them. So honestly, I just feel like I would never feel safe. But I need to look that up, the Warren Williams story, and see, he's probably still in jail. He was 14 at the time. I know he's an adult by now, but I don't remember what his sentence was. I think it was a good long time though. There's more details about what he did to his mom. So his mom comes home through the garage as he's laying in wait. He says he loves her because I guess he was closer to his mom than he was with his dad. And it seems like maybe his dad was more of his target than his mom. But obviously with what he did to his dad, he knew his mom would never forgive him. So he says, "I love you." Shoots her in the head, the face, the heart, and like shoots her multiple times because he didn't want her to know that it was him that was doing this to her. Drags her downstairs to the basement and covers her with a sheet. Then, because of his Romeo and Juliet obsession, he plays Liebestod, probably butchering that, from Tristan and Isolde on repeat afterwards. And when the police came in later, they said it was such an eerie scene because this song was on repeat. The house was eerily quiet. They're moving through. They find the bodies. And later on, I watched actual crime police footage of them going through the house and finding the bodies. And you could see the bodies under the sheets. And it was so surreal to see.
Well, we can tell upon approach that there's loud opera type music playing, and it's very loud, and it's to the point of being distracting. And the house is completely dark. Okay, we notice only one vehicle in the driveway. That's a Volkswagen van. And for all intents and purposes, it appears that no one is home. And the first open door we come to was in front of the residence on the main floor. It's best described as eerie. The music's coming from somewhere on the right of the room. There's a fireplace on the left of the room. There's a smell of wood smoke from an open fireplace. The room is cool, and you can tell that it's probably heated with wood. So it's got a cabin type, except that it's eerie. It's dark, the music's loud, there's bullets on the floor. It's to the point where we are yelling over it. We're trying to announce ourselves that we're the police, we're here, whoever may be in the residence. And you have to yell to be heard over that music. It's a CD of Romeo and Juliet. And it was set on continuous play. So it was playing when we got there, and it had been playing over and over, apparently.
On the carpet.
And you have some indication that Bill and Faith Kinkle are going to be dead. I believe a paperclip from the office is used to unlock the bathroom door on the main floor. And just inside that bathroom door,
footprints.
I see a gentleman that's obviously deceased. He's laying on his back. He's covered with a sheet. His feet are up against the door. We have to kind of move his feet away from the door so we can get in there and check on him. At this point, we are still missing one parent, and we're going through systematically and checking doors. And it is found that a small door just off the main hallway has a narrow flight of stairs that goes down. And we go down in there. And there's evidence on the floor. There's a considerable amount of blood on the floor. And on the basement floor, on the concrete, we find Faith Kinkle. She's also deceased and covered by a sheet.
Because, you know, you take Oregon, beautiful state, and they lived in what looked like a really green part of the state. Because, you know, part of the state's really green and lush, the other part is desert. So they lived in this like cabin-like home in the middle of these woods. Beautiful setting, but kind of secluded. And the house on the inside just looked like a normal house, or it looked more like a cabin. And, you know, you have this family, and it's like all these juxtapositions in your head where it's like, you know, happy family, beautiful home, compared to what ultimately winds up happening, like a family destroyed, this house is really ruined forever. I wonder if anybody ever bought the house. That would be interesting to find out, because I would never be able to go in that basement. Basements are scary enough as it is. He left a note on the coffee table saying that he did what he did because he didn't want his parents to be embarrassed of him. And a quote from the note says, "My head just doesn't work right. God damn these voices inside my head. I have to kill people. I don't know why. I have no other choice." And he also left homemade bombs in the home. He waits for daylight, puts on his trench coat, concealing all of his weapons, drives his mom's Ford Explorer to the high school. Inside of said trench coat, he had 5 weapons. 2 hunting knives, a rifle, 2 pistols, over 1,100 rounds of ammunition, and parked 2 blocks from the school, walked to the school. My kid was just coming up to say goodnight to me, and now I have forgotten where I was. So, Kip gets to the school. He shoots 2 students in the patio area of the school. But before that, he sees somebody that he knows as he's entering the school, and he tells them, "You need to get out of here." And I swear, in school shooting stories, you always hear about that. Like, for whatever reason, they come upon the first person and they just want to seem bad, and they're just like, "You need to get out of here." I don't know why. I feel like that's just, it happens in every school shooting story. But one of the kids that he shoots in the patio area later died after being on life support at the hospital. And then the other one was wounded but survived. Then he went to the cafeteria that was filled with 300 students. He hit 37, killing 2. A wounded student, his name was Jacob Riker, who later on found out that he had a perforated lung, but would go on to make a full recovery and got a medal for being a hero by the Boy Scouts. He and 6 other students tackled Kiplin when he tried to reload. And honestly, that is amazing, because you never know what you're going to do in a situation like this. I've had some active shooter training courses, just like, I worked in HR before. I've worked in universities in HR, obviously at schools. These kinds of things, sad as it is, have a higher chance of happening. So you really should know what to do beforehand, you know, if you can. It's good to think about these things, think these things through beforehand so that you have some kind of reference point, so that you don't freeze, so that you can try and get out with your life, basically. So when I hear about students or people coming together and taking somebody down like that, it's super brave. It takes, you know, you have to think on your feet. And obviously, you know, you have to have multiple people willing to do that. And had they not done that, so many more people would have died. But it was very fortuitous that he had to reload because, well, I was going to say no one would get shot, but I think he does wind up shooting one more time and injuring somebody And as the students rattle him to the floor, he says, "Just kill me." But he was able to be restrained until the police got there. When he got to the police station, he tried to stab a police officer with a knife hidden in his leg in an effort to be killed. What do they call it? Suicide by cop. But old boy got pepper sprayed instead. I don't know. It also brings up another point for me. My video is probably... I know that the people that I watch that do true crime videos, they often have to speak in some kind of code. There's like a lot of words that you can't say. There's subject matter that you can get in trouble for. So I know, I don't know, like this video slash podcast is probably gonna be a no-go. I don't know what's gonna happen with this video, but so there's a lot of stuff I'm probably saying that I shouldn't say in this video is what I'm getting at. But given what he did to his parents, I mean, the school shooting is horrible. All of it's horrible. But to your own parents, like, how do you go on? Like, how do you then, after doing what you did, how do you not have the guts to take yourself out? I don't understand it. Like, I couldn't keep going if I did that to somebody. Like, it would just be a given. Like, shortly after, like, I just would off myself too. Like, I don't understand. I don't know. I don't get how you have the guts to do this to somebody else, but you're too scared to do it for yourself. I personally don't understand that. Because honestly, worse than, like, a fate worse than death is living with what you've done every day. That's not a life. That is, like, that is hell. So at the school after the shooting, 200 counselors volunteered their services. $400,000 was given to the Thurston Healing Fund. A scholarship was created in remembrance, and a permanent memorial was created at the school. At Kipp's trial, he pled guilty, and he was sentenced to 111 years in prison with no chance of parole. And this was to be served in Oregon State Correctional Institution. Later on, he would get his GED, a college degree, become a yoga instructor, and now advocates for other minors with life sentences, but does not believe that he deserves to be advocated for himself. He doesn't believe that he deserves to get out, anything like that. He reportedly has a lot of guilt over what he did and doesn't want to continue to re-traumatize all of his victims. However, even though I've just said that, he appealed in 2007, saying his lawyers should have taken him to court using the insanity defense. But in my understanding of the insanity defense is it's very hard to get. And I am no professional in any stretch of the imagination on anything. But from my understanding, to get the insanity defense to be found guilty by reason of insanity, the key is you have to have not known what you did was wrong at the time. And I believe he knew it was wrong the whole time. So you can have a mental illness, but that doesn't mean that you're insane. After reading all of the Wikipedia of the story, which I know, obviously, Wikipedia, I mean, it's a good place to start. I remember in college, like, they said, you know, don't utilize it for your sources. It's a good place to start, but, like, you know, find some other sources. So after I read the Wikipedia about the story, which pretty much echoed everything that I had heard in the other podcast that I that I've listened to about the story, I wanted to do a little bit more digging because I just wanted to find out everything that I possibly could. So there was an article or a college paper of some kind, a criminal interpretation of Kip Kinkle by Ernest Oleski from Cleveland State University. They cite the social bonding theory in their article. So it says the less bonds that you have to society, you have nothing to lose when committing a crime. And as I said before, going off Prozac cold turkey instead of tapering, having a past depressive episode puts you at risk for a future one with suicidal or homicidal ideation. Routine activities theory says there's a suitable target, a motivated offender, lack of guardianship for crime to occur. Research conducted shows schools are the most suitable target in modern America. Kip's sister, Kristen Kinkle, did a PBS interview, and she described her parents as good people who loved other people and other cultures. They lived in Spain for a time. She described herself as a mediator between Kip and their parents. So she was 5 years older than Kip, and Kip's parents had kids later in life. So they were much older and less, I guess, in touch with what was going on with kids at the time. So when Kristen was still living at home before she went off to college in Hawaii, things were a little bit more chill at home. She left, everything pretty much went off the rails because she was not there to mediate between her brother and her parents. So the last time that she saw them, her dad and her brother, was at Crystal Mountain Ski Resort after a teaching conference that her dad had. And that was really weird because I used to live up there in that area, and I've been to Crystal Mountain Ski Resort one time. And it's odd that so many years later I was there, even though there's really like no relevant, like the one doesn't have to do with each other except for the fact that I was at the same place at a different time. But it is weird. It's like, I really feel like places have energy. And I'm not like a religious person, but like, I don't know. I do think that there's like a little something more out there. And I definitely believe in energies. Like I definitely, any place I go to, maybe not any place, but like some places I go to sometimes have very distinct energies. Sometimes it's bad, sometimes it's good. So it's just, there's like a little bit of a tie there for me, a little bit of a connection. I found the letter that Kristen wrote to the judge, and I'll read some of it. It's kind of long. Says, I am shaken by how difficult this letter is for me to write. I was told that you may need it to be better. You may need it to better understand my little brother. I wish there was an ideal place to begin, but where does one start when a loved one's life is laid across someone else's table? What keeps me believing in him and loving him is the fact that he is a good person that came from a good home. I feel silly writing that because it seems so contradictory looking at what actually took place. However, it's the truth and it keeps me alive. I wish more than anything that you, the man that decides his fate, could know him like I do. So a little bit of the Kip Kinkle that I know is where I will begin. Growing up with him, he was very average. I was the typical big sister and he seemed like every other little brother I ever had any contact with. Only with hindsight do I truly see the signs of someone who was in desperate need of help, different help than any of us knew how to give, which that's fair because I don't think anybody ever expects for your family member to do what this boy did. Kip was a very compassionate person. Like my mother, the norm for him was to put others first. He absolutely loved animals and treated them better than most. He was a people pleaser. Okay. He is hurting more than any of us can imagine, and yet is adapting to an extremely unpleasant situation better than most ever could. He is realistic about his situation, yet remains hopeful that he will find something positive in it. Girl does have plans for the future and has discussed this with me, his ideas of becoming a productive member of society, even from behind bars. Girl, if he did get out, what kind of relationship could you guys have? How are you guys gonna celebrate holidays? Mother's Day, Father's Day, any kind of holiday where families would gather, knowing your parents are no longer around because he killed them. And honestly, how do you not think to yourself, had I not been at college, would he have killed me too? She was the golden child. Could he have had resentment? Could he have said, well, I'm killing my mom and dad, might as well take out the whole family? All of his hopes and dreams have to do with getting an education and using it to help people without one. The first visit with him after this happened was at Skipworth and consisted of only crying. It took weeks for him to make eye contact with me and even longer to say something. When he finally did, it was, I am so sorry. I believe he is aware of the pain that he has caused and is just as shocked as the rest of us that he is capable of such horror. And honestly, I don't know very much about paranoid schizophrenia, if that's what he actually had, if he truly wasn't in his right mind, like he didn't have control. I mean, honestly, like that's the scariest thing I could possibly think of, is being out of your mind, having no control of your actions, and doing these things to your family. I mean, if you truly don't have control, it's like you left and you don't have control of your body, and then once your mental health is under control and maybe you're medicated, you come back to your body and are like, I did what? And then you have to live with that. Like, honestly, that's the most horrifying thing that I could think of. And if that's what happened, oh my God, you know? But I really just don't know how it all works. I don't know how much he was actually in control of. I don't know. All I know is I don't think that I can continue to have a relationship with the family member after that. And it's sad for everybody involved. And you could say on the one hand that she's really strong, that she can continue to have a relationship with him, that she can have the understanding that it wasn't him who did these things, if that is true, and put aside like her hurt and her loss. I don't know, it just seems very, very complicated and very hard for me to wrap my mind around. I told him to go to a safe place in his memory and not to listen to the victims when they talk, because they are angry and are going to say things they don't mean. Girl. He stopped me and said, no, I owe it to them to listen. Yeah. I share this story because I think it emphasizes the kind of person Kip was and still is. I think it also shows that there really should be no concern for this kind of thing to happen again. Girl, again, listen. If he has paranoid schizophrenia and he has to be medicated, what if he goes off of his medication? What do you mean there is no concern for this kind of thing to happen again? Girl, I love my brother more than I ever thought possible, and not because he needs me to, but because I need to. It is a difficult concept for an outsider to understand, but it comes from what is inside us. He will need support, love, medical help, etc. But most of all right now, he needs hope. Okay. One thing that I found that was very interesting, when I went on YouTube to search Kipling Kinkle, I found a video from the Oregonian from like the day of the shooting. The police took Kip back to the school and basically did a walkthrough. They had one officer that was talking to him, asking questions, another person behind the camera recording everything. They start outside, move their way inside, and he's asking him, what did you do here? What kind of weapon did you have? You know, just the play-by-play. And that was just wild. You know, Kip was handcuffed. He was very, like, soft-spoken, just really looking down the whole time. So weird to see. I mean, everything was still on the ground, like all the bullet casings and everything that, like, the school was just as it was, you know, it was a crime scene. And I've just never seen a video like that. So I will try to put a little bit of it in here. But if you want to see the whole thing, I think it's like something like 11 minutes long. And it's on YouTube and you can watch it.
This 1998 time is at 1:51 p.m. And next to me is Kiplin Kinkel, K-I-N-K-E-L. And this is basically going to be a walkthrough on a video of an incident that occurred at Thurston High School at 333 North 58th Street, Springfield, Lane County, Oregon. Kip, you understand that we're going to be videotaped, and the videotape's going to be turned on and off at various points. We've got so much ground to cover. Do you understand that? Okay. When you arrived here at school this morning, you arrived here, you told me, a little before 8, is that correct? Okay, where did you park? Okay, we're standing on the north side of the school grounds at Thurston High School, just west of the tennis courts, and where Kip parked his mother's Ford Explorer, is that correct? It would be down and beyond what you can see the asphalt down there, right? Somewhere in the area of 61st and D Street, is that correct? Okay. You weren't dressed like that when you came to school. You weren't dressed like this when you came to school. Okay. What? You had a long trench coat on, is that correct? And you had kind of pants, hacky pants, is that correct? Okay. And were you armed?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, he's gonna have to speak up. He's gonna have to speak up a little bit.
Yeah. I had five. You had five weapons. You had two knives. Is that correct? And you had three firearms. Is that correct? And one of those firearms was a Glock 19 semi-automatic pistol. Is that correct? And the other was a 22 semi-auto Ruger 22 caliber pistol. Is that correct? And the third one was a 10.22 Ruger semi-automatic rifle. Were these weapons loaded? And you had all the weapons on you when you walked from down there to right there?
Yes.
And where were they at? Is this stuff that you brought?
Yes.
Is that your backpack?
Yes.
And is that your bag?
Yes.
How many rounds are those banana clips? 25 of these. How many of those do you have?
Two of those and 150 round clip.
Two of those and 150 round clip? You recall which clip was in the rifles? The 50 round clip. So you started with 50 rounds. Okay. Why did you do this?
I had no other choice.
You had no other choice. Any of these students make you upset or anything?
And another thing about this video that I was just talking about is the cop that is talking to him seems so unfazed by everything. He obviously must have seen some things in his career because he's just very, very even going through and talking to Kip. He's talking to him like he could have been talking to him about what did you have for breakfast. It was so weird to watch. At the end of this video, the police officer asks Kip why he did it. And just like he said in his letter, he said he had no other choice. Going down the YouTube rabbit hole of videos, I found a Clarity Child Guidance Center YouTube video. It was this woman, I think she might have been a psychiatrist, psychologist of some kind. She was giving a presentation probably to her peers, and she was talking about different violent offenders. One of the videos was on Kipling Kinkle, and there's an audio interview with Kip about how he killed his mom, and he's very upset in it. It's very different. His demeanor is very different in this audio versus what you see in the video from the Oregonian when they're taking him through the school. There's a lot of emotion in this audio, and I will put in part of it if I can, because I feel like it's important to hear these things from the source, because I could tell you all day long, but I don't think it'll have the same impact.
And this is his confession with the detective.
So your mom comes home around 6.
Yes.
Now, I've never been to your house. And earlier you talked about a basement. Is that a garage that's underneath the house? Or?
Yeah.
Okay. So your mom drives in her car, right?
Yeah.
And what is she driving?
Explore?
Yeah. And she parks. Where are you at?
Waiting for her.
Okay. Outside or inside?
Inside.
Okay. She pull into the garage?
Yes.
Okay.
Do
you have one of these automatic garage doors where she closes the door after she pulls in?
Yeah.
Was the door up or down?
Down.
Okay.
I just want to die.
I know.
Oh, God.
So, you told me that your mom gets out of the Explorer and starts up the stairs from the garage. Is that right?
Yes.
Do you say anything to her?
Yes, I told her I loved her.
YouTube, titled Crime Documentary, The Kip Kinkle Story. The guy who narrates this has a very pleasant and familiar voice. I swear I've heard him. Probably he's narrated other documentaries before. The documentary opens up with his sister talking about how she found out about what he had done. And this documentary was done very shortly after the shooting, because she still looks very, very young in it. And then they interview some of his classmates and former friends, and they're still very young too. But his sister is so childlike in the video. She speaks like a small child. And she's at least college age at this time, if not after college. And she makes excuses for Kip. She's so upbeat in the interviews and protective of him. She even laughs at one point when she talks about how her dad didn't believe in psychologists. And in that moment, I'm thinking, like, do you not think that you would have been dead too if you were there? Like, I don't understand her, and I can't relate to her at all.
My mom was the one who said, this is what we need, we should do this. My dad wasn't too excited about it. I think he felt that psychologists were kind of like chiropractors in the sense that they may not be as heavily needed as we think.
Earlier, we talked about how his dad, with all of Kip's issues, thought it was a great idea to buy him a gun. So his dad's friend is interviewed in the documentary, and he says that Kip's dad said that he had to buy Kip a gun because if he didn't, it would be forbidden fruit. And he was worn down so much that he got Kip his first gun for his 12th birthday. My niece is 11. I could not imagine somebody giving her access to a gun. We all know that Columbine was really, like, at the time, the biggest school shooting story that anybody had ever heard. They were pretty rare before that, but before Kip did what he did, there had been a string of school shootings, and he had talked about things that other school shooters did wrong, that he would do better. And in the documentary, these shootings were referred to as a new phenomenon. And they had recently at the time happened in Mississippi, Kentucky, and Arkansas. That's pretty much it on the documentary. I mean, pretty much repeats everything that I had found up until this point. It kind of came to an abrupt end. I don't know if there was maybe more to it, and just the YouTube video that had put up the documentary ended, and, like, I don't know if it was the full documentary. It seemed like it was. A Real News Network YouTube video, the person in that video interviewed a HuffPost reporter who did the one and only interview that Kip has ever done about being sentenced as a juvenile to over 100 years without parole. There are bills being passed about not giving kids life without parole, but it wouldn't apply to Kip because it's not retroactive. And she interviewed him very, very recently over COVID. She interviewed him over 20 hours, which spanned over a 10-month period during the pandemic. And yeah, this woman reminds me a little bit of Kip's sister, because she described him as an incredible human being, kind, compassionate, and thoughtful, meticulous and thoughtful in his answers. And she also talked to his sister, who continues to support him to this day. And I looked her up, and I think she's, like, currently lives in Florida. She moved around a little bit. She lived in Connecticut for a time. And I think most recently she's in Florida. Kind of interesting because it's, like, literally on the opposite side of the country from her brother. And she claims to have talked to some people in that same Oregon community where all of this happened, that they hope that he gets out. And they say that they would live next door to him because they think he's reformed. I hope he stays on his meds. So that was the interview that this reporter did with a person from the Real News Network YouTube channel. I went and looked at the actual HuffPost article. So again, this is the only interview that he's ever given. He was worried that if he ever spoke to the media, that it would be re-traumatizing all of his victims, that it wouldn't do any good, it would cause more harm than good. He just does things behind the scenes for people like him that deserve second chances, although he still doesn't believe that he deserves a second chance. The article says that the U.S. is the only country that sentences kids to life without parole. And I know that even in this country, that's still pretty rare. I mean, a crime would have to be particularly heinous, I think, for the court to look at a kid or a teenager as an adult. I guess this fit that. I don't really know, but I think even sentencing kids to life in prison is still pretty rare. So on the voices in his set, he says that he rarely hears voices anymore. And when he does, they are quiet and garbled. But even when he understands them, he has the understanding of what is happening to him, which, to be fair, understanding what's going on with you is very important. After I had Vivi, I had what I knew to be extreme postpartum anxiety, and I felt like I was losing my mind. But I knew what was happening to me. I knew that I could go talk to somebody, I could go on medication if I needed to. I did get through it on my own, but honestly, in hindsight, I wanted to get through it on my own, and I had the knowledge of what was going on with me. That's the point here, is that he knows what's happening to him now, so he no longer is controlled by the voices. And that's powerful, to have that kind of control over your mind. Same thing with me. I knew that I was having postpartum anxiety, and I knew that I would get through it. I knew that it would lessen over time. I would get better. I would get back to myself. And I did. So that is powerful. If you know what's happening to you, it makes all the difference in the world. So he says, they don't hold a powerful influence over him anymore. But he talks a little bit more about when he first started hearing the voices when he was 12. He said, he heard a male voice say, you need to kill everyone in the world. And when he first heard it, he was walking back to the house after getting off the bus from school. And he actually thought that it was somebody from behind him. So he ran inside, scared of the invisible voices. Eventually, he would hear three male voices. They were all distinct, and they would argue with each other and talk shit about him. It's not funny, but you know what I mean. He thought that Disney and the US government put a chip in his head. And at the time, Ruby Ridge and Waco had happened and furthered his fear of government taking his guns and the Chinese invading the West Coast. He says that the voices came and went and usually happened on bad days. When he went to jail, he spent 18 months in solitary confinement awaiting trial with the voices in his head. Oh my God. And this, as you can imagine, made his illness all-consuming. And there's a bunch of talk in the article about kids' brains not being fully developed and yet still getting charged as adults for particularly heinous crimes. Then I found clips from interviews with students that he tried to shoot, students that did get caught in the shooting. Another student on crutches who says that she hates his guts and would never forgive him. Lots of police footage about, you know, of the house, and what happened there. Just little snippets. I found just little snippets of like news articles, from the time, a bit of a time capsule of the people and things that happened there. So.
Casual, like, just put the gun up against Mike's head and pulled the trigger, and then put it in my head, pulled the trigger, and, you know, then that's when I got up and hit him three times, and then he was tackled, and I ran into the office and told him to call 911, and people had been shot.
I'm glad I don't know him, because I think I hate his guts, and I could never forgive. I know people who say, well, I forgive him. I can't forgive him. He's ruined not just just the people's lives, but pretty much this whole town. Everybody's lives was pretty much somehow affected by this, and it won't be the same. It's not like, well, we can just get on with it, because that's not what's going to happen. It'll never be right and the same again.
That is basically all I have on that. It's good to be back making Spooky Mom episodes. I hope to get on a roll and make a lot more. And if you like this video, consider subscribing to the podcast. Anywhere you listen to podcasts, subscribe on YouTube if you want to watch video form. And I will see you in the next story.